killing. We also know that a number of the people who are killed by police are disproportionately represented by poor people. And an alarming number of police killings of mentally ill people occur during wellness checks. Just in the past few months in the United States, you might have heard of the killings of Sonia Massey, a Black woman from Illinois who was killed during a mental health crisis and during a wellness check. You might have heard of Victoria Lee, an Asian woman from New Jersey who was killed during a wellness check when she was having a mental health crisis. And you may even remember, in Canada, Regis Korchinski Packett, an Indigenous Ukrainian Black woman who was killed by Toronto police in 2020 when she was having a mental health crisis during a wellness check. These are just some of the names of the many mentally ill people who have been killed during these so-called checkups. Beyond that, you might have heard of Hoss Lightning, a 15-year-old boy from Samson Cree First Nation who was recently killed by the RCMP after he called them for support when he perceived that he was in danger. You might have even heard of Vanessa Denteria, the Afro-Latina Colombian newcomer who was quite literally killed last week by RCMP during a wellness check in her own home. She was killed in front of her toddler. Let's not forget, in the short course of 11 days earlier this month, 6 First Nations people were killed during police encounters. That is an appalling number, though unfortunately not surprising given Canada's colonial legacy and the role that the RCMP and police have in the settler colonial exploits of this state called Canada. So I very strongly oppose the idea of having wellness checks performed on people who are experiencing suicidality. There's a post made by the grassroots organization Project Let's that summarizes this idea very well. They write, "Welfare checks do not create safety for people in crisis. Calling the police on someone experiencing what you perceive to be a crisis is always an escalation to what is happening. When you call the police, you're activating a power that can get somebody killed. You are activating a power that can lead someone to lose their housing, their employment, their health insurance, their children, their pets, and their rights and dignity as a human being." I think this is a really strongly worded way of saying, you know, please stop relying on the police to try to take care of our loved ones, suicidal or not, because they can't. Well, then you might be thinking, well, then obviously I have to go for the other option, Leslie, which is to take my loved one to the emergency room. But as I said, I don't think that's a viable option either. Oftentimes, those who access emergency services at the hospital are forcibly institutionalized when they disclose suicidality. Ironically, those institutionalized are subjected to sanism by the very workers and professionals who claim to offer support. As Perlin writes in 2013, sanism is, quote, "rooted in the stereotypical view that most people with mental disorders are uniquely irrational, deviant, and dangerous. It is based in the presumption that human behavior is or should be rational, and sanist biases are the negative attitudes and discrimination towards a group of people based on their mental health status or their deviance from, quote unquote, typical mental health status and behaviors," end quote. In psychiatric institutions, patients are subjected to constant invasive surveillance by nurses and doctors, and their right to advocate for themselves tend to be ignored or they're not even offered. Instead of addressing the root issues, sometimes psychiatric institutions simply treat a patient for a surface issue. But as we discussed earlier, there is no one profile that fits all suicidal people. A suicidal person could be so because they're constantly having to choose between paying rent or putting food on the table for their kids. Or a suicidal person could be a queer teenager who can't move out of their homophobic family's home. In such cases, does a prescription for an antidepressant really address the root cause of the issue of suicidality? I think a big concern that I personally have with regards to how people lean into emergency services to support suicidal people is that the majority of medical, psychiatric, and mental health professionals actually are, pardon my French here, quite at navigating suicidality. If you have felt a little bit called out whenever I have mentioned how people act weird about receiving a disclosure of suicidality, don't worry. You are not alone in this, because our doctors, our nurses, and sometimes even our therapists act the same way. And they're supposed to be the ones who have been professionally trained to support us. Dr. DeQuincy Mefren-Lazine, the suicidologist mentioned earlier, discusses that openly in his interview on the Ologies podcast. When he began his career studying suicide 25 years ago, he, a survivor of a suicide attempt, was the person who had to write the book on suicide because all of his colleagues in the psych field were so clueless about it. And this is an ongoing issue as well. In my personal experience, I can't tell you how many times doctors and counselors would tell me to check myself into the emergency whenever I disclosed suicidality to them. I would be sobbing in their offices, completely not knowing what to do with myself, and their best course of advice was to tell me to take myself to emergency. In preparation for today's episode, I discussed this with my therapist, who shared her opinion about it as well, and I'm really glad that we're aligned on this. She told me that, in her opinion, a lot of mental health professionals are unable to sit with the discomfort of receiving a disclosure, and so they often lean into referring clients out to emergency or to police. And so this is a really big issue, because suicidality, as I've been talking about throughout this time, is really complex. It requires a level of care and attention which we're not likely to receive by the police, nor the psychiatric system, nor apparently most other mental health or social work or healthcare systems. So if that's the case, we have to consider what is put at risk. If the pain is not adequately addressed, if there is no space created by these institutions of protection and health to explore healing in person-centered ways that are non-brutalizing and non-discriminatory, how can we go about adopting a harm reduction approach to preventing suicides? And how can we actually help foster healing? I think that this particular question is one that is inherently political, which is why I mentioned that I think suicidality and suicide is a political issue, because I think that it most prominently appears as a political issue when we really inspect how these systems claim to support mentally ill people, and they can't. They're unable to. In a lot of ways, I think that's why we really have to center disability justice and other anti-oppressive values in suicide prevention, because it's really not only about wellness checks and about forced institutionalization. It can also be about policy around healthcare, right? And or maybe for a more illustrative term to use, lack of adequate healthcare and social supports. We see people trying to access medical assistance in dying in Canada using the broad eligibility requirements that the government has conveniently put there. In cases where disabled people are no longer able to afford rent because of pension cuts, and they can't also afford medication to help them with their disability at the same time. And even the Canadian government wants to try to expand medical assistance in dying for people whose sole reason to access it is because of mental illness. Rather than investing in affordable housing and food security programs, rather than investing in poverty reduction programs and social supports, this is what the federal government is trying to do. They're trying to expand this state-sanctioned suicide. And so here I think there's also like this paradoxical or maybe even philosophical question around what makes suicide prevention then so special if medical assistance in dying is so accessible to a lot of disabled people who are not able to, let's say, afford rent or afford foods or to be able to purchase medications. And at the same time, there are a lot of people who can't afford to do those things, and they become suicidal because of it. So part of me is actually like really cynical about any kind of like federal or provincial government campaign for suicide prevention, because MAID is just so accessible for people, and it wants to, and the government wants to make it even more accessible for folks. And the ways in which politicians just discuss like mental health issues, for example, like addiction, as being, you know, something that puts communities in danger, and therefore BC needs to expand involuntary treatment for people who are addicted to drugs in order to keep communities safe. Those are David Eby's words, not mine. I think sometimes that is what makes suicide prevention so complex, because what care should be there, it is not. The task to care sometimes feels really daunting. But I want to make one thing really clear, which is that all hope is not lost. I think that there are actual tangible ways in which we can do suicide prevention. It just seems as though these structures that are supposed to protect and hold our wellness in best interest don't care. But it all comes back down to human connection and to community. And I'll be talking all about that in the final part of the episode, right after this PSA.
This is Bird Note. A yellow-green vireo sings on its summer breeding grounds in Belize. This migratory songbird looks remarkably like the red-eyed vireo, commonly seen in the eastern U.S., with a bright white eyebrow and striking red eye. In the fall, most yellow-green vireos head to South America to wait out the winter months. But wait, this particular vireo is going north instead. You're going the wrong way.
You're going the wrong way!
What?
You're going the wrong way!
For reasons biologists don't fully understand, some birds change orientation, often by a full 180 degrees, and travel almost the same distance as the rest of their species, but in the opposite direction. The phenomenon is called misorientation. It's one of the most common errors in migration patterns among songbirds, especially those in their first year. For this reason, every now and then, a wayward yellow-green vireo ends up northward in, say, California. Unfortunately, many of these birds that we call vagrants never find their way back to their native range. But some of the disoriented birds do eventually find the proper route, getting more comfortable with the journey each year. For more about how to see rare migratory birds in your area, start at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
You're going the wrong way!
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Leslie, and I'm talking about suicide prevention on Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. Now, I've talked at length about suicidality and pain and critiqued at length about the structures and power that are supposedly supposed to care for people who are suicidal and those who are mentally ill, and that very oftentimes puts them in further danger and further harm. Now, I'm going to talk about the hard part, which is how to prevent suicides. And that's the thing. It's very simple, and at the same time, it's not a skill that very many of us have, and so it can feel really scary to do it. Here are some pointers, though. I think the first thing that you should really do when receiving a disclosure of suicidality is to sit with that person and to, in some people's words, bear witness to their pain. Really try to listen to where they're coming from and to understand that your role has shifted in that moment. You are not just a person who is their friend or their family member. You are a trusted individual who is given information about them that they probably wouldn't share to most other people. You cannot break that trust. Now it is up to you to show up with care and responsibility. Do not let your discomfort overshadow the urgency of the person who has disclosed. And understand that the most basic rational thing for you to do is to listen, is to see the pain that they're going through and to validate that pain. Because not all people fit into one single profile of why they might be feeling suicidal or experiencing suicidality. You have to listen to where they're coming from. Try to avoid doing the thing of just giving them a crisis line phone number. A lot of the times that doesn't work, because let me share this sad fun fact with you. Sometimes the people who pick up the call on the crisis line, they are just as unnerved by disclosures of suicidality. I have literally had people hang up on me when I have called the crisis line. I can laugh about that now, but it is truly a horrible feeling to be abandoned by the crisis operator. A crisis phone line is not going to help somebody who is experiencing, for example, oppression or facing like food insecurity or houselessness or like other daunting material issues. So I strongly discourage you to use that as your first method. Rather, what you can do is listen to what the person is telling you and consider your resources. In a post titled "You Do Not Need a Certificate to Care" by Taylor McNally of the Walls Down Collective, which is an Alberta-based community care and crisis phone line organization, she writes, quote, "I know the world has made you think otherwise, but we all have our own special skills, experience, and resources to contribute to the work being community care." And I think this is really, really helpful when considering preventative measures for suicide as well. Because what we know for sure is that there's no one single profile that fits a person who is suicidal. A person might feel suicidal because they may not be able to eat again that week, and they've had that experience for a number of weeks on and off for the last couple of months. A person might feel suicidal because they are experiencing abuse at home. The question is, what can you do in order to contribute to creating safety for this person? Perhaps it's contributing to mutual aid or setting up a mutual aid fund for somebody who is lacking financial resources. Perhaps it means looking up ways in which someone can access safe long-term housing. Maybe it means validating their experiences of oppression and giving yourself the task to understand more about the history of their marginalization as a part of a group of people who are oppressed. And then also becoming an advocate for people who are experiencing that form of oppression. And so here comes another thing that I want to share, another pointer about suicide prevention that I think could be quite helpful, which is to understand that anti-oppression is really an integral part of suicide prevention. I'm going to read some words by Vicki Reynolds in this post by Project Let's. They write, "Suicide is not something that happens to one person, and it is not something that one person does. Nobody simply kills themselves. Events occur in context, and because we live in a society that has not delivered on the promises of social justice, which we are well qualified and able to deliver, we have to structure into our analysis of a person's death the context of social injustice in which they lived. As change agents, I believe we need to belong people who have been told by hate that they do not belong on this earth, and we need to participate in delivering justice to them and to all of us. Resisting hate, practicing solidarity, and transforming society to be inclusive and just is suicide prevention in its most radical form, because social injustice, hate, stigma, and oppression create the conditions that make the horrors of suicide possible. When we think about suicide prevention and mental health care, I think we really have to go back to what I was talking about before around police killings, around forced institutionalization, around the ableist and sanest policies that governments create in order to, do something about people who are mentally ill. I think mental illness and suicidality rarely is isolated. It exists in relation with other experiences of oppression a lot of the times, and a lot of experiences of social injustice. In order to be able to properly bear witness to pain, as mentioned in the first suggestion of how you can support somebody moving through suicidality, in order to do that effectively, we have to be able to understand the root causes of pain that are oftentimes they come from structural and systemic oppression. They come from legacies of colonialism. They come from the impacts of intergenerational trauma and racism. I think for a lot of people, it's unrealistic to expect them to crisis call hotline their way out of suicidality, because some folks, they're going to experience it long term. They're going to experience it multiple times in their lives. And so anti-oppressive advocacy is really, really integral to how we show up in care, to how we bear witness to pain, to how we show we truly love and support the people in their lives who have disclosed suicidality. As we wrap up today's episode, I want to call back to something that my therapist told me while I was preparing for today's episode, which is that in her years of being a therapist, she's really seen the transformative power of community. Community has this healing property that allows for people to really just feel better, or at the very least move on into the next day with some hope and some motivation. And so I think that's one of the reasons why I keep trying to convince you, like, if you really are serious about suicide prevention, like, you gotta show up. You gotta be a loving person. You gotta be a loving community member. We can't do it all by ourselves. We have to have our own networks of support as well. But in creating any network of support, in putting together like networks of care, we have to, I think strategically and want to, you know, kind of like expand so that it becomes this intricate web of support. And that's it. I think that's all I really wanted to say today. There are a lot of really good resources that I looked into in preparation for today's episode, in addition to talking to my therapist about it, in addition to looking back on my own lived experiences as being a person who has experienced suicidality and having received disclosures of suicidality and reacting in different ways to those disclosures. I just want to share a little bit more about where I got my knowledge from today. So the Ologies episodes about suicide and also about pain were super, super helpful. And as well, the writings of Project Let's on Instagram, also on Instagram, Taylor McNally, known as Taylor Made YYC, who is an educator, abolitionist, and organizer with the Walls Down Collective. And as well, the Instagram page known as Criminalized Mentally Ill by a researcher named Kendra, who writes all about disability justice, sanism, the legal system, and incarcerality. Really cool stuff by her as well. Go check those out if you want to learn more. This has been a really heavy episode of Typically Tuesdays, and it's one I've been wanting to talk about for quite a while. So thank you so much if you stuck it out with me, and I hope you learned something new. I hope I gave you something to reflect on, and I hope you become curious as to how you can support your community even further. Tune into more great CJSF programming. Check out Raccoon City, which has a tone completely opposite to today's episode of Typically Tuesdays. You deserve it. You deserve it. Raccoon City is a fun music show with your host Katie every Tuesday at noon to 1. Check it out. It's a great time. Raccoon City, Tuesdays noon to 1, here on 90.1 FM CJSF. One last song for you today. I promised something hopeful. This is a track by one of my favorite bands, Tallies, off of a record that I keep listening to, I keep coming back to. This is When Your Life Is Not Over. Thanks for tuning in to Typically Tuesdays. Take care, and I'll talk to you very soon.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby.